From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, bloody Syria, John Edwards walks, bad jobs numbers, hot politics. It all ended in a mistrial for John Edwards yesterday, so much the jury could not decide. Edwards spoke on the courthouse steps in Greensboro, North Carolina.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal, I did an awful, awful lot that was wrong.
A primary win in Texas clinched the GOP nomination for Mitt Romney on Tuesday. In Las Vegas, he went after the president.
I know he had a lot of you folks thinking things were going to get real good, and he's been a big disappointment, hasn't he?
Hold on, said Obama's David Axelrod in Boston, going after the former Massachusetts governor's record and promise.
Romney economics didn't work then, and it won't work now.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Dan Murphy of the Christian Science Monitor, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you say on bloody Syria? John Edwards, the jobs numbers, just 69,000 jobs created, we're told, this morning in May. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Washington, Byron York, columnist and chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
With us in the studio, Dan Murphy. He writes the Back Channel blog for the Christian Science Monitor, covers the Middle East and the world. Welcome back to you, Dan.
Hi, nice to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Byron, and Dan.
I was going to go to John Edwards, but then we've got these jobs numbers. People were saying 150,000 jobs is kind of a ballpark. That would be a little disappointing, but sort of a come-see, come-saw number. Instead, it's 69,000 jobs. Byron York, what do you say?
It's bad. There's nothing good about it. I also look at something called U6, which is the basically the unemployment rate, plus all those people who want a job, are not looking for a job, but they've looked for a job sometime in the past year, but they've just given up. That's 14.8% right now. So the numbers are almost worse than they seem on their face.
Unemployment from 8.1 up this time to 8.2%. Jack, we're going to come back to politics here, but just in terms of what human suffering, we need more jobs in this country, and we need them fast at a time when Europe's got all these problems and it's just not chugging here.
We certainly do, and this when graduates are just leaving the colleges now, and the long-term unemployed number, I think, is unprecedentedly high. You know, you have to wonder. I mean, last fall, the president came forward with several stimulus measures. Mark Zandi at the economy at Moody's economy.com estimated it could they could create 1 million jobs or more. The Republican Congress debunked those. Would those have given some insurance against this downturn? We don't know, but I think that's one of the alternatives that was lost out there.
Dan Murphy, no man is an island, we're told. No country either. Europe, with all these problems, we've got some backwash right now in this country.
That's the underlying issue that I think is going to be a major problem for the U.S. economy. I don't care what Obama does, what Mitt Romney says he can do. We have Greece that already is imploded. I think it's going to end up having to leave the euro. Spain is now asking the European Central Bank to pony up a lot of cash.
Billions, 50 billion. What's the latest?
50 billion euros is what they say is needed to recapitalize their banking system. They nationalized one of the largest banks called Bankia. There's a lot of toxic waste in the Spanish banking system, and Spain ain't Greece. And the Germans don't want to bail everybody out. So at the very least, there's going to be stagnant economies and probably shrinking economies in Europe, and that can't be good for us.
Let's reel it back home, and then we'll go to politics. John Edwards on those steps in Greensboro yesterday, Byron. There were plenty of charges against him. It could have added up to decades, hypothetically, more than hypothetically, in prison. Instead, not guilty, a handful of others where they just couldn't decide. It's a mistrial. Are we all done with this, Byron?
Yeah, I think we are. You have to start out with the boilerplate of saying, I think John Edwards is a really sleazy guy.
He said so himself in a way yesterday, didn't he? He said, I wasn't criminal, but I was so wrong.
That said, I don't think this is a case that should have been brought. I think it was a reach for federal prosecutors to try to create a federal crime out of this. And I'm not surprised that it ended up this way. And I don't think Edwards should have gone to jail. That said, hopefully it's the end of his career as a national figure.
Well, there could still be aspirations there. He was talking about how God may still have plans for him yesterday. Jack,
you know,
Meadey,
he wanted to be Attorney General even as
well, yeah,
breaking around him. So the man is sometimes not completely connected to reality.
I guess God wasn't fully on board with that one, not so far. Jack, what's the moral of this story?
Oh, the moral of the story is people that look so good need to be really have a close look taken at them. I first learned of Mr. Edwards, I think, in around 2003 when a reporter told me that he had appeared before a group in Iowa and he had made a protectionist speech, a group of industrial workers. When he came off the stage, the reporter said to him, "But Mr. Edwards, you favor free trade." And he said, quote, according to the reporter, "They don't know that." Meaning the workers who applauded. That tell you a lot about this guy. Also, you know, reporters on the campaign trail said the man never read anything. He never seemed to care enough to read even about the problems of the country. Instead, he had, you know, little summaries of things. Again, he looked terrific. He had a populist story, and both Edwards and Mrs. Edwards really colluded in deceiving the electorate.
Dan Murphy, what do you see in terms of American justice here? I mean, Byron says, and others have said the same, you know, these charges should not have been brought. Here's the jury saying, we just can't decide. Maybe it's a reflection of a kind of an accurate sense of what a muddied bunch of charges it was, or not.
I think so. I mean, I think that there was a sense in a way that he was being punished for being a sleazy guy. I mean, here's this fellow who, you know, you might as well cast him as kind of the vapid but incredibly telegenic political candidate who really is all about power and is not what you see, I think, as Byron just said, in terms of what he publicly presents. You know, but is it criminal to be a jerk? And that's a very difficult thing to do. And you know, the ins and outs of finance laws, I don't fully understand. And it's probably very, very tough for a jury to understand.
I mean, Byron, the irony here, a criminal be a jerk. Well, today you could just have the super PAC set up, go to them for the money for the mistress, and it would all be legal.
Well, I suppose that's right. I'm not sure, as long as there was no coordination.
No coordination. I just happened to support her and the child. Oh, dear. Let's look beyond John Edwards' mistress, a ruling from an appeals court right here in Boston this week on the Defense of Marriage Act, saying it is discriminatory. It is not constitutional. This will be headed for the Supreme Court. Jack, how does this rock land in the pond?
Well, that majestic phrase from the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the laws, that seems to be what's at issue here. And the court ruled that there was that the discrimination involved here, namely that the federal government can't recognize marriage rights of people married in Massachusetts if they're married to members of the same sex, isn't justified, that there's no way to justify that discrimination. You can't simply say, well, because this has been the way it's been since time immemorial. And when they look back at the record of DOMA in the Congress, they found no rationale there that could stand up under the standard of strict scrutiny, the standard you have to meet in order to justify any kind of discrimination.
Byron York, U.S. Court of Appeals, First Circuit here. And with their ruling, there's no immediate effect because they stayed the ruling, anticipating an appeal to the Supreme Court could come as early as next spring, would be the first case involving the same-sex marriage law to be decided by the court here, New York Times reporting. Well, there's the First Circuit's view of the U.S. Constitution. Is yours different, Byron? What do you think? Equal protection under the law. What do you see coming from the Supreme Court?
Well, it's certainly going to the Supreme Court, that case, plus the California case will certainly be the Supreme Court's definitive word on gay marriage. Personally, I mean, the Defense of Marriage Act did two things. It established a federal definition of marriage as between a man and a woman, and it also allowed states to not recognize gay marriages from other states, so that if a gay couple is married in Massachusetts, Oklahoma does not, and they move to Oklahoma, Oklahoma does not have to accept them as a married couple. I don't think that really works as a permanent system. I have always been against the judicial imposition of gay marriage. I mean, if a state legislature does it, as they did in New York State, then that's what the legislatures have done. But as a judicial issue, I think it's one of these things that the court should probably stay out of.
Jen Murphy, it's an American issue here, but the world watches. What do you pick up, you know, globally, as the no doubt the world pays attention to this very big country dealing with this very central issue to a society?
I think they do, but we're not exactly the leader in this area. So mm-hmm. Certainly parts of Europe are. And again, in terms of the wealthy countries, we're far more conservative on a lot of these social issues. Mm-hmm. Do I see the Supreme Court, which I think probably will end up striking down DOMA, having a major impact in countries in sub-Saharan Africa or Egypt or in Saudi Arabia in terms of their attitudes towards homosexuality in general and marriage in particular? Probably not, at least not for decades. But certainly America can be a leader in bringing change to other places.
Byron, this Roberts Supreme Court on DOMA, what's your guess about which way it will go?
You know, I don't know. I mean, this is like – it's like healthcare. What can you say? I mean, we know that Justice Kennedy has said, to my mind, some kind of fuzzy-minded things about, I don't know, the ability for people to find their place in the cosmos or something like mm-hmm. that. So it's entirely possible that Justice Kennedy is going to go and vote in favor of gay marriage. I know Scalia, it was years ago. I shouldn't speak off the top of my head. I think it was the Texas case. He said, look, gay marriage is coming. This case is coming sometime, and it's here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Bloody Syria. John Edwards walks. Defense of Marriage Act takes a hit. New Mexico burns. Big wildfire there. Byron York is with us today from Washington, from the Washington Examiner. Dan Murphy's with us. With me in the studio from the Christian Science Monitor, covers the world and the Middle East, writes the Back Channels blog for the Monitor. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Massacre in Syria and so much unease about it as the blood flowed over the last week. There's a press conference on Wednesday. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, with her fears that two possible peace options in Syria could both fail, sparking a regional crisis. She outlined that scenario.
The violence escalates, the conflict spreads and intensifies, it reaches a higher degree of severity, it involves countries in the region, it takes on increasingly sectarian forms, and we have a major crisis not only in Syria, but in the region.
Syria, bloody as can be, and just from bad, terrible, to worse. Dan Murphy, this is in your wheelhouse. What do you see unfolding here?
Everybody is holding their breath and trembling, and that's what Susan Rice is saying right there. The sectarian fault lines are deep. They're real.
Minority Alawites rule. You've got Sunnis up in arms and bloodshed both ways.
Yeah, and Christians and Kurds, yes. And a history of sending Sunni jihadis over the border into Iraq during that country's terrible sectarian civil war. Lebanon on the border has a history of this. We had a story the other day out of Lebanon where there's already training camps for Sunni jihadis to go in and fight Assad. And the big unspoken thing that the Obama people aren't saying, but they're well aware that if we intervene and the Sunni side of this equation wins, particularly the more militant and radical angles, there could be a genocide. There could be a lot of dead Alawites someday. And we don't want to be on the hook for that.
If there's a Sunni takeover, you mean, in Syria. But, I mean, we've already got piles of murdered children here just in the last week.
Yes, we had a terrible massacre, 108 people in Hula. We've had about 10,000, 11,000 killed in the past year. The problem is those numbers, there's going to be buckets of bloods there. And do you want to be on the hook for it as an international community or as the United States? Or do you want to stand back and do nothing? Those are two bad options. But that's where we're at right now.
What does that mean? The Alawites in charge, Assad in charge, Hillary Clinton and others have said he will go. Can he go without the Alawites going? Is there people talk about a Yemen solution here where you keep the same basic power structure but put somebody new in?
Who? I mean, that's something that people keep suggesting. But, you know, it isn't Bashar Assad. He is not the evil king on the top of his mountain. If you remove him, peace will reign in the land. The Ba'ath regime around him is very strong. It was very strong around his father before him, who ruled the country, who, by the way, you know, won his big war by massacring 20, 30,000 people in Hama in 1981 or 82. We've seen this movie before. And you know, we talk about 110 people Dead and Hula last Friday, and you know, how can the world not act? The world didn't act when he did when they did Hala.
And yet, here was Hillary Clinton yesterday in Copenhagen, Denmark, talking about the importance of Russia's role in possibly pushing for an end to the conflict in Syria.
We have very strong opposition from Russia and China, but it's primarily Russia. And that makes it harder to put together an international coalition. The Syrians are not going to listen to us. They will listen maybe to the Russians, so we have to keep pushing them.
But now we read today, Byron York, the Russian Orthodox Church may be part of what's going on here, resisting get involved, watching the Christian population in Syria. I mean, you're in Washington, Byron. Is there any taste for intervention here?
Well, there's certainly taste to offer some assistance in getting rid of Assad. I mean, the problem is it's a much bigger, worse problem than Libya was, where Libya had, you know, Gaddafi had a couple of helicopters and some tanks. There's a serious, you know, military force over there. So I think what Dan was saying is exactly the situation that confronts American policymakers, which is there's no good option. And you look at a situation like that and you think, what can our military force do with these factions and this current situation? And the answer is not a whole lot.
This is not Libya. You've got sophisticated Russian air defenses. You don't have any part of the country that's really held by rebels that you can get in and defend or support, Dan.
Right. Within a day and a half of the uprising beginning in Libya last year, the whole eastern half of the country had fallen. Mass defections from Gaddafi's government, from his very weak and unprofessional military. There's been a year of this, more than a year of this, in Syria now. The military class is held firm. The regime is held firm. There are pockets of trouble. There are not large swathes of territory outside of Assad's control. And as I think it was Byron pointed out, they have something like 3,000, 4,000 decent tanks. They have 3,000 or 4,000 various types of Russian versions of Abrams, armored personnel carriers, armed defenses, air defenses, and about 600,000 men under arms. You're not going to lob some bombs over the border with air power and, you know, the happy rebels are going to win.
And yet people trembling about what may unfold here. We're going to talk more about this Syria story on Monday. It is a very big one. Let me get Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I was it took my breath away, the recent article in the New York Times about Obama's kill list. And I was just wondering what the guests think about what would happen in another time and place in our country if a president decided that he could just murder anybody who he thought he felt was an enemy of the country. It's all done in secret. He can even kill American citizens, and he can kill people in countries that we're not at war at. And it just is breathtaking. I would think at another time this would be impeachable offenses without, I think a first-year law student would look at this and say, clearly impeachable offenses.
And if you're hanging out with a terrorist who gets killed, you're automatically defined as a terrorist yourself. Dan, I mean, this is the surprising part here was that how high it goes in the administration, right up to the Oval Office. Some of these decisions about the kill list, when the drone attack will come down, and if you're there, you're gone.
Yes, you have a president of the United States without any direct judicial oversight, certainly without a very clear internal review process, pushing the button on people overseas, and some of them are American citizens, as the caller points out. Obama, I'm sure, believes he's only getting the bad people, and I'm sure they are quite careful with their targeting. But as you say, a great number of people are collateral. We say they're terrorists, but they happen to be people that are in houses or in cars with these people and aren't particularly involved in anything, certainly not a danger to us. The really scary bit is that the history of American presidential power is that it only seems to go in one direction. And when a president takes on new powers for himself, he bequeaths it to whoever succeeds him, and they carry the ball from there. And so, you know, this kind of thing becomes institutionalized in its way. I'd find that very frightening.
Byron York, What do you say to this moving of the goalposts? I hate to use a frivolous metaphor here. There are a lot of lives, but national security as well. What do you see happening, Byron?
Well, I'm kind of conflicted about it. Obviously, I believe when a drone hits Al-Awlaki, I was perfectly fine with that. On the other hand,
American citizen, but big promoter of.
In my view, an enemy combatant. Mm-hmm. But yes, he was born in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
For conservatives, this is one of these. Well, what if Bush had? You know, what if the story had been about Bush? There would be a lot more uproar. I would say one thing about what I think is going on. The Obama administration has painted itself into a corner about the judicial treatment of terrorist suspects. It tried to move Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's trial to New York into civilian court. That did not work politically. They have not been unable to close Guantanamo, and yet they are committed to trying to extend civilian judicial constitutional rights to terrorist suspects. And I have to say, in these cases, it's easier to kill these guys. And I do sense that that is what's going on with some of these terrorist suspects, that it's much easier to hit them with a drone than to capture them and then have to give them American constitutional.
Well, that raises all its own issues. Jack, I'll come to you. One call first. Ed in Lexington, Kentucky. Ed, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Okay.
Hey, you know, it's not like Obama came up with this stuff. I mean, you know, this all happened after 9/11. W started this stuff, you know. I mean, we got to look back to Bush, and he set those rules. Obama didn't step into office and say, hey, guess what, I can kill anybody I want to. You know, those rules go back pretty far, actually.
Well, I mean, yes, a lot of things changed after 9/11 and changed under President George W. Bush, but Obama has aggressively embraced the drone campaign. Jack, what do you see unfolding here?
It reminds me of the saying, ambition makes the politician but breaks the man. I mean, the New York Times, which broke the story, I think asks the capital question about it. You know, they say the president pursued, how can we know, the Times asks, whether he's pursued all methods short of assassination or instead to avoid a political charge of weakness, built up a tough-sounding list of kills. Are the kills to protect the country or his career? Has Obama's ambition silenced his conscience? A unilateral campaign of death is untenable, the Times concludes. You know, to remove the taint of political ambition from murder, the evidence justifying these kill orders must be run by an outside court.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking about. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
You know, first of all, let me get to the clown show with Donald Trump. But I'd like just like to mention on this topic here. You know, the man is damned if he do, damned if he don't. If he wasn't taking out terrorists, Dick Cheney, that great war hero, would be all down him, and the neocons and Republicans and conservatives would be down his throat about that. If he do, they're down his throat about that. So he might as well just govern.
Point taken, Carl. What are you thinking at home on politics at home, Carl?
Well, politics at home. Here's the thing. The reason why people are missing the point of why a guy like Mitt Romney would feel comfortable with going to a fundraiser with a race fighter like Donald Trump is because we fail to realize and recognize that that's what the Republican Party is now. A few years ago, a Republican would have never done something like that. John McCain would have never done something like that. In fact, he blasted back at people who wanted to go with that type of rhetoric.
You're talking about Donald Trump going back to the birther theme this week, saying President Obama wasn't born in the U.S., and you see that as race baiting, Carl?
I see that as race baiting at its ugliest. And like I said, John McCain pushed back on those type of things. And now Mitt Romney, instead of celebrating becoming the nominee for the Republican Party for president, he was in Las Vegas with Donald Trump.
Yeah, yes, he was, Carl. Let's listen to a little bit of, a follow-up on that. There was a contentious CNN interview with Wolf Blitzer on Tuesday. Donald Trump was questioning whether President Obama was born in the United States.
All I know is that there are many, many questions from many different sides as to the authenticity of his birth certificate. And all I know is last week somebody came out with a very strong statement saying that he stated himself that he was born in Kenya and raised in Indonesia. Now, I didn't make that statement. That was made by, I assume, either the publisher or the president himself. And That's a statement. That's a pretty hard statement to refute.
Well, not really. CNN host called Trump out as he continued this birtherism in that interview. Trump stuck to his guns. Here's that exchange.
Donald, you're beginning to sound a little ridiculous. I have to tell you.
No, I think you are. Wolf, let me tell you something. I think you sound ridiculous, and if you'd ask me a question and let me answer it...
Here's the question. Did the conspiracy start in 1961 when the Honolulu Star Bulletin and the Honolulu Advertiser contemporaneously published announcements that he was born in Hawaii?
Byron York, what is Donald Trump still doing on the stage with Mitt Romney at this stage in the campaign season?
Well, I have no idea why Trump has gone back to this birther stuff. I can't explain that. But I can talk a little bit about what the Romney people feel, because I've talked to them about this.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel they don't agree with Trump. They feel there is a repudiation game being played out there in which some supporter of Romney says something objectionable, and then, of course, there are calls for Romney to disavow him, distance himself from him, to repudiate him.
Well, why wouldn't he? He's a candidate for president. When it's right in front of him, why wouldn't he?
They feel that there is a slippery slope here, and there will be somebody today and somebody else the next day. They look back to the McCain campaign. There was actually this actually happened in the McCain campaign. McCain was at a rally in Ohio. A local radio host introduces him, gives kind of a red meat speech, refers to Barack Obama three times by Obama's full name, Barack Hussein Obama. Mm. McCain apologizes, distances himself from this, and repudiates the whole thing. And, of course, several months later, the president is standing in front of the Capitol saying, I, Barack Hussein Obama. So the Romney people think if you start down the road with this repudiation stuff, it won't ever end.
But if you're running for president and you don't stand up against that kind of thing, calls for the, you know, try him for treason and all the rest when you're on the campaign trail, why should people think you're going to have backbone when you're in the Oval Office, Byron?
I don't see that issue as being the same. I just don't understand. So if he doesn't repudiate Donald Trump, then he won't have the ability to, I don't know, work.
Well, if you play footsie with race baiting on the campaign trail, doesn't that telegraph something to the public about your spine when you govern?
Well, the other thing that Romney is determined to do is to absolutely keep his focus on the economy, the economy, the economy. And the whole race stuff, what can you say? I don't think anybody would accuse Mitt Romney of having any involvement in that, of sharing any sentiments. So, look, there's always, and it is true in campaign after campaign, mm-hmm. and more so for Republicans and Democrats, there's always somebody to repudiate. There are calls to repudiate this pastor or this person, and Romney has decided that he just does not want to go down that road.
Jack, what about it? The let it be philosophy on the campaign trail?
Well, you know, fear of alienating the birther vote really led him, Mitt Romney, to appear with Trump in Las Vegas. For the sake of his ambition, really, he lowered himself to embrace that national joke. I mean, it just raises fundamental questions, it seems to me, about his character. Is there anything he won't stoop to be president of the United States?
But it's Donald Trump stooping, isn't it?
Well, it is Donald Trump stooping, but why would Mitt Romney want anything to do with such a clown and with such a person who really plays with fire on this birther issue?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, last night, the Scripps National Spelling Bee, 14-year-old Snigda Nandipati from San Diego, won by correctly spelling guet-apens, a French word that means ambush or trap.
G-U-E-T-A-P-E-N-S, get a pawn.
Try that at home. Mayor Michael Bloomberg said this week he wants to ban supersized sugary drinks over 16 ounces in New York City.
We're not taking away anybody's rights at all to do anything. All we're doing is forcing you to recognize that you're drinking an enormous amount of sugar.
And bluegrass guitar legend Doc Watson died this week at age 89. Here he is on Blue Railroad Train.
Blue Railroad Train, leaving me here alone. You're treating me good, you're treating me bad, and making me think of home.
Just great. Sad to see him go. What a legacy. We're looking at a week in the news. Bloody Syria, John Edwards walks, Defense of Marriage Act takes a hit, and all kinds of politics this week. Byron York is with us from the Washington Examiner. Dan Murphy from the Christian Science Monitor. Our own Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. Let's go to Luke in Nashville, Tennessee. Luke, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Pleasure to be with you. The point I want to raise was that the GOP has already come out and said that if Mitt Romney is elected, that his job as president is to advance the social conservative agenda of the GOP, that he can have his own thoughts and ideas on some minor policy issues that don't really matter. But his main job is to advance, you know, the GOP, not to do what's right for the American public, but to advance their social conservative agenda. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Luke, I appreciate your call. I mean, Byron, let me bring that to you. In the context of this really interesting debate, vote we saw this week in Texas, Texas Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison is headed out, GOP primary there. And you had the Lieutenant Governor, David Dewhurst, longtime big figure, up against former State Solicitor General Ted Cruz. Neither candidate won a clear majority in that Tuesday election, but Cruz, a Tea Party favorite, really got people's attention with such a strong showing up against the kind of mainstream contender there. And here he is talking about the victory in sight for him, maybe for Tea Party perspective as well.
The first battle was fought on my opponent's terrain in the primary. Now we move into the runoff. And the runoff is decided by the conservative grassroots activists of the state of Texas.
Byron, you read Republican politics pretty well. What do you see going on there?
Well, Ted Cruz is a very impressive guy, argued a lot of cases in the Supreme Court, just an extremely impressive individual. And I'm just not very surprised at it, given what we saw with Murdoch in Indiana and in Nebraska. We have seen people who are viewed as establishment politicians or establishment candidates, and by that I mean Republican establishment candidates, mm-hmm. knocked off by insurgent candidates. There's no doubt about it. I think
insurgent, as in Tea Party leaning.
Exactly. I think in Nebraska we saw, and the name is the winner has just popped out of my head, but we saw Sarah Palin actually exercising quite a bit of influence in that race, which I was a little surprised at. I didn't think Palin had the juice right now to do that, and she did.
So what does that mean to Luke's question? Does it mean that Mitt Romney, should he win, will or will need to govern as a Tea Party president?
No, Luke said cultural conservative agenda, mm-hmm. and that's just not right. I mean, that's not something that all you Republicans are completely united on. Of course, there are cultural or social conservatives. But obviously the concern of these people is jobs and the economy, just like everybody else.
But it's got a pretty strong social conservative fringe on it. We saw that in the primaries. That was in no small evidence.
Well, the number one issue in all of the exit polls was jobs and the economy.
Yeah, and yet a lot of people hung in that primary for a long time, riding a lot of different colored horses there. Let me go to Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. Francis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see, Francis?
I'm a Democrat. I did not vote for Rick Scott, but I just see all this fear-mongering going on, and knowing about Rick Scott's involvement with Columbia Medicare fraud, and then hearing that some people voted for him anyway, knowing this, to send some message to Washington, which I don't know what it is. Maybe it's racial. I don't know, but people voted for him, even elderly here, that knew about his involvement in Columbia Medicare fraud.
You're talking about, the Florida governor, and they've got what's being called in some quarters a purge of the voter list going on there now, Francis.
That's right, and it makes a person feel helpless. But all I know is that in 2010, the midterm votes, the people who were there for Obama in 2008, and he's not a perfect man, I know that, mm-hmm. but they didn't show up in 2010. So then there was this wave of so-called grassroots conservatism, the Tea Party fear-mongering, and all these conservatives got in. And I read both sides when I go to the poll. I'm not a straight party ticket voter.
Yeah.
But once I start looking at both sides, it's kind of obvious to me that there's fear-mongering, and I want to vote for progress, not going backwards and purging voting records and what have you.
Francis, I appreciate your call from Florida. Jack Beatty, how about it? Here we've got Ron online, says, more evidence this week in Florida. Other states said extremists who have hijacked the GOP are going crazy like raccoons in a kitchen. They say they want to clean up the voter rolls, Jack.
Yeah, somebody estimated that 35,000 voters could have lose their franchise. A federal judge has stepped in. The Justice Department has said you've got to run this by us because Florida is under the Civil Rights Voting Rights Act prohibitions or scrutiny, and county commissioners throughout Florida are saying, hey, wait a minute, the people you're throwing off the list are legitimate. One of them, in a newspaper report, Porter's dream was a 91-year-old veteran of the Battle of the Bulge who suddenly couldn't vote. So it may be that nothing will come of this in Florida. We don't know. Of course, Florida, it isn't alone in this. What are there, 18 other states, 16 other states that have passed tough voter restriction laws? On the other hand, of course, the Supreme Court has blessed the Indiana law, which requires people to have driver's licenses or some comparable form of identification. And critics point out that after the Georgia restrictions, I think in 2008, turnout actually even among African Americans went up in the next election. So we just don't know. But it's clear that Republican governors and legislatures have not been shy about using the power of government to sort of set the political table for the optimal Republican result.
Byron, what do you think? Crazy raccoons in the kitchen getting tougher on voter rolls or just good voter hygiene?
Crazy raccoons in the kitchen.
Watch out.
All right.
Put away the tuna sandwich there, quick.
I think I have absolutely no problem with voter ID laws. The Supreme Court has upheld them. I am persuaded by the argument that in our society today you have to present a driver's license to do a zillion different things, like entering lots of buildings, buying some antihistamines, getting a hotel room, getting a plane ticket, all of these things. And so I don't see that as a problem at all.
But shouldn't voting be among our more wide open activities in a free democracy? I mean, your Battle of the Bulge veteran has got 30 days to prove he's there or he's off. You know, why discourage people from voting? Do we really have a big problem with voter fraud? I don't see evidence of it.
Well, we have people are registered to vote, right? I mean, we have some. We have some restrictions on voting, right? You can't just arrive here from France and say I want to vote today. So we have some restrictions on voting, and asking a person to show that he is who he is, it strikes me as a completely reasonable restriction on voting.
I want to bring it back to the issue on the economy. There's going to be a lot of concern about who gets to vote, and those efforts, no doubt, from both sides. We had the Obama and Romney camps going back and forth this week on the economy after Mitt Romney clinched the delegate count with the primary in Texas. David Axelrod, the Obama campaign honcho, showed up in Romney's campaign headquarters town, Boston, stood in front of the Massachusetts State House, of course, Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts, and went after Mitt Romney's record as governor. He was nearly drowned out sometimes by a crowd of jeering Romney supporters, trooped out from the headquarters maybe, who had gathered across the street.
A recent poll showed Governor Romney trailing badly here in his home state. These may be the only voters right here for Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. It's a harsh judgment from the people who've come to know him best.
David Axelrod saying Romney economics didn't work in Massachusetts, 47th in job creation out of 50 in that time, his state was, and it won't work in the future. But Mitt Romney went out to the shuttered big headquarters, empty of Solyndra, bankrupt solar energy company that was bankrolled by the Obama administration in no small amount, something like $500 million, stood in front of it almost all alone. It was a surprise sort of last minute that he showed up, just a few press there. Here's Mitt Romney taking it to President Obama.
Free enterprise to the president means taking money from the taxpayers and giving it freely to his friends. Heads and his cronies win. And tails, and the taxpayers lose.
Jack, what do you see in the back and forth on the economy this week?
Well, I see both things struck me at least as stunts, and the Romney people even hid where they were going and from the reporters until the last minute. Mr. Romney said we didn't want the president somehow interfering in this. You know, I think Solyndra is a fair issue for Romney to raise, but the whole question there is pay and play. You know, you pay and you play, or you play and you pay, and that's exactly the issue people are raising against him with Wall Street. He promises to repeal Dodd-Frank, and this week Rolling Stone is out with a portrait of 16 or so millionaires and billionaires who are paying him a lot of money, to many of them Wall Street people, just for that reason. So he's got to be careful with raising the issue of campaign contributions and political favors.
Of course, over the years, Barack Obama with no small volume of contributions from Wall Street people as well.
Certainly true.
And now these bad numbers, job numbers today, and Republicans certainly very ready, and maybe a lot of others who, without a job, to jump on that. Here was Eric Cantor, Virginia, on CNBC this morning, blasting those numbers, blaming, the Obama administration and their regulatory policies, he said.
This is terrible. I mean, these job numbers are pathetic, and I think it just really cries out for us to actually try something new now. We've seen again and again the repeated policies of government regulation, of more prescription coming from Washington, all adding uncertainty.
Dan Murphy, is that what these numbers are about, government regulation?
No, that's absurd. There is a big international economic problem. You know, the recession that began at the end of the Bush administration is deep, devastating. Are there a lot of things to criticize Obama about? Are there things he could have done better? Yes. Is the fact that we still have an Environmental Protection Agency the reason that the jobs report last month was so terrible? No. Cantor is banging on about the thing he always bangs on about. And really, it's just not, you know, if his answer is no regulation and everything will be great, that isn't very deep thinking there.
Tom in Longmeadow, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make a comment as regards my perspective on Governor Romney. I've come to the conclusion that I don't believe he has any courage. He doesn't have the courage to stand up to Donald Trump for fear of offending him. He's not stood up at all against anyone on Wall Street indicating that there might have been a problem there with some of the problems we've experienced since 2008. He didn't have the courage to release his income tax returns until he was pushed against the wall. When it came to the situation regarding what he would be doing in Iraq and what he'd be doing in Afghanistan, he said he'd deferred to his generals. It sounds as if he's always going to be looking somewhere else and not wanting to offend anyone. And my perspective on that is when you do that, you try to please everybody and end up satisfying no one.
Well, is it no courage or politically smart, Tom?
I think it's no courage.
Yeah, voters are going to get to decide that one. I appreciate your call. One more right here, Perry, Iowa. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to end the program with congratulating Mayor Bloomberg on addressing another crucial national issue, which is obesity and the healthcare issue. And I just hope in an election year, Obama starts to address these issues, which support and help promote his healthcare bill.
Well, I mean, Michelle Obama's been out there very loudly saying, let's lose a few pounds, America. Kyle, I appreciate your call. Byron, what about it? Here's the New York mayor. And he says, we don't want these supersized sugary drinks. It may not be everything, but we've got an obesity problem in this country, and nobody's stepping up to do much of anything about it.
By the way, is there a ban on buying two 12-ounce sugary drinks?
No, there's not. No, and I mean, I guess that's his point. You can buy two if you want, but we're going to put a little speed bump in the road.
Well, look, what can I say? I think this is the mayor going, this is the government going too far in this case. I just don't see why the government has to limit the number of ounces that a business can sell of a soda.
And what about when the nation's drowning in fat? What do we do, Byron?
Well, we don't outlaw 16-ounce sugary drinks.
Jack Beatty, how about it? Do we just roll on? You saw the teenagers with diabetes, the percentage in prediabetes just through the roof lately. What do we do?
Well, you could say that there's a compelling public interest here. That is, the expenses that, that will incur for the rest of the society dealing with decades of people with diabetics and other problems from this kind of sugary consumption. So you could it isn't just the nanny state. It's the thinking of the taxpayer here, too, I think.
The mayor this week saying, drop that super chug. We'll see how that works out. Dan Murphy with the Christian Science Monitor. Great to have you today. Thanks for joining us.
Real pleasure.
Byron York at the Washington Examiner. Byron, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And a program note today, we love getting On Point out of the studio. We've taken the show all over New Orleans, Minneapolis, Salt Lake City, Southern California, Buffalo. We like it best of all with a live audience, On Point Live, we call it. Next up is right here in Boston, June 14th at the fabulous Paramount Center. Big-time environmental thinker and activist Bill McKibben will be our special guest. Musical guest, the great Martin Sexton. Jack Beatty will be in the house, no less. We'll have the thrills and spills of live radio and a chance to mix and mingle with you. If you're in Boston or anywhere near, come along for the show and the fun. June 14th. All the details at onpointradio.org. You can continue our conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Be first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts on all the upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.